have shown their affection for B Movies by adopting the letter B as their last name. Their production company is named B Movies. Their latest film, which opens today at the TLA, is titled Vortex. It's a new wave subversion of the detective genre, which stars punk singer Lydia Lunch in the lead role of the detective. The target of her investigation is a multinational corporation, which is trying to destroy its competition for a U.S. Defense Department contract for outer space laser weapons. Scott B. will join us at 4 o'clock this afternoon. That will be followed on Fresh Air at 4:30 by an interview with chef and television personality Julia Child. She'll host a new public television series titled Dinner at Julia's, which will premiere this Monday evening on public television. Because of the terrible traffic conditions today, we are anticipating the possibility of schedule changes throughout the afternoon, so be advised of that. With me now on Fresh Air is David Ogilvy, who is the founder of one of the four largest advertising agencies in the world, with 140 offices in 40 countries. His company, Ogilvy & Mather, was named Agency of the Year by Advertising Age magazine in 1982. Ogilvy's own work is known for his emphasis on well-researched presentations. His print ads usually include several columns of copy describing the product. His early work includes campaigns for Dove soap with the slogan, Dove creams your skin while you bathe, and Rinso. One of his Rinso ads included an illustrated chart showing the different stains Rinso can clean with directions on how to treat each stain. Ogilvy's Rolls-Royce ad was headlined with the understated boast, at 60 miles an hour, the loudest noise in this Rolls-Royce comes from the electric clock. The ad continued, what makes Rolls-Royce the best car in the world? There's really no magic about it. It's merely patient attention to details, says an eminent Rolls-Royce engineer. This magazine ad then featured 13 paragraphs, each elaborating on a special characteristic of the Rolls. For many years, Ogilvy handled the Hathaway shirt account, for which he created the classic image of the Hathaway man, a distinguished-looking man with an eye patch over his right eye. For 18 years, Ogilvy designed ads for the Schweppes mixers, which used the face of his client, Commander Whitehead, as the model for and symbol of the product. Another Ogilvy creation is the old Pepperidge Farm baker riding down the road in his Pepperidge Farm horse and buggy. At the age of 72, Ogilvy is now semi-retired. He has several homes, but spends most of his time in his 12th century chateau in France. His first book, Confessions of an Advertising Man, was published 20 years ago. He's written a new book. It's called Ogilvy on Advertising, and it's just been published by Crown. David Ogilvy, welcome to Fresh Air. I'd like to start by asking you about how you developed your own style. Can you tell us about the first ad that you remember creating?
Well, that was a disaster, and I'm ashamed of it. It was before I came to the United States, and it was for a cooking stove. And the illustration was Manet's painting, Déjeuner sur l'herbe, where there's a model without her clothes on, having a picnic in the Bois de Boulogne with three painters, and I thought that was very charming. But what it had to do with cooking stoves, I can't imagine. Anyway, it was a silly thing to do, and I know better now. But we're all ashamed of some things in our past, and I was a callow youth at the time.
Part of the shock of Déjeuner sur l'herbe is that there's a naked woman at this picnic in the painting. Did that send any messages to you about the usefulness of sexuality and advertising?
I don't think I put it in because she was naked. Because she hadn't got her clothes on. She wasn't at all sexy looking. Now I would never use a naked woman in an advertisement. It's not done much in the United States. It's done practically not at all. It's an awful lot of it in Europe. I think it's silly. There are some excuses for it. If you're advertising bath oil, it's reasonable to show a person taking the bath, and I can forgive that. But I don't think it's a thing to do. I would never do it.
Well, you did use the bath ad for your Dove soap campaign.
Yes, she was in a bath, wasn't she? But she was as unnaked as you can be and still be photographed in a bath.
She had a very thick layer of suds covering her body.
That's right, yes.
You came up with the slogan, Dove creams your skin while you bathe. Was it your emphasis or the manufacturer's emphasis on the cream in Dove?
It was mine. Lever Brothers asked me to advertise this product they were bringing out at that time called Dove. And I asked to see the formula of it, and I read the formula, and I noticed it contained something called stearic acid. And I said, what's that? Quite a lot of it, 25%. And they said, stearic acid is a thing that's in cleansing creams, cold creams. I said, that's very interesting. So I said, it's 1/4 cleansing cream. It will cream your skin while you wash. And that tested very well in a test of different promises we could make. And it's still being used about 29 years later. It sold a lot of product that I'm rather proud of it.
How do you test something like that?
Oh, you test various ways. There are a dozen ways of testing these things, and it's a very boring subject. I came out of research. You know, before I was in advertising, I worked for Gallup and the Gallup poll thing at Princeton. So I've always had a very strong bias towards research. I don't get up in the morning without doing some research.
At the bottom of one of the Dove ads, it says, "If you don't agree with our claims, we'll return every penny you paid." Does anybody actually do that?
I never heard of anybody. I suppose some people do.
Now, you also did the early Rinso campaigns.
I hope we're going to come to some campaigns I did which were successful. This was another mistake I made. Rinso. And the headline was How to Take Out Stains. And it showed a whole lot of stains and how to get them out. Coffee stains, lipstick stains, chocolate stains, and the blood stain. And the blood was actually my own blood. When we were making the ad, I pricked my finger and squeezed some blood out, which was duly photographed. And I think I can say that I'm the only advertising man who ever bled for his client.
Well, an indisputably successful campaign that you developed was for the Hathaway shirts, in which you created the Hathaway man. Do you want to describe what he looked like and how you came up with that?
I just read a book called Attention and Interest Factors in Advertising by a man called Harold Rudolph. And he'd found that the more story appeal you could get into your photograph, the more people would read your copy. And I had to advertise this shirt. It was one of the smallest budgets in the world. It was about $50,000. And I had to build a national brand with $50,000, which generally costs millions. So I wanted to put in the photograph some element of story appeal. And I thought if I put an eye patch on the man's face, it's interesting. It suggests that the man has got some adventurous past. So that's what I did, and it lasted for about 30 years. I've never quite understood why it was so successful. I don't understand most things, but it did. It was a great success, and it made me famous. It made Hathaway famous. I must confess I would have preferred to find fame from some more substantial achievement.
Did you have a story in mind for how he got the patch on his eye?
No, none at all. We found this man who we used as the model. He was a greeter in a hotel in New York. He was a white Russian called Baron Rangel. He was very difficult to photograph because he was drunk all the time. And he swayed in the wind, and we had to strap him to an iron pipe to keep him still. He also turned blue in the wind. And then after a time, he disappeared. He was so attractive looking in the ads that he married a very rich woman, went off to Spain. And I lost him. Then a couple of years later, I met him in New York, and I said, "Would you do some more advertisement? I'll pay you $1,000. And if it's any comfort to you, it's the highest model fee in history up to that time." And he said, "I will do it, but you know," he said, "old boy, this is so much bigger than either of us." Pompous ass.
How do you know when an ad's being successful? The Hathaway man campaign ran for 18 years.
The only way to know an ad's being successful is at the cash register. If the client's sales go up, the advertising campaign is being successful. And my motto is, we sell or else. I don't regard advertising as an art form, you see. I regard it as simply an instrument, often a fairly efficient instrument of selling things.
For the Dove soap campaign, you researched the ingredients and decided to go with a campaign that was based on that. The Hathaway shirt campaign wasn't about... Well, actually, it was about that, too, because beneath the Hathaway man, there were several columns of copy describing the quality of the shirt.
Yeah. Very good shirts, too. I wish I could afford them.
Do you have to have faith in a product that you're selling before you advertise it?
Yes, I've found I have. I've got no particular moral scruples about it, but I've noticed that I have occasionally done advertising for products I didn't personally like. I once had a food product, and I thought I couldn't eat it. It was disgusting, I thought. And I did my best with the advertising, but somehow or other it wasn't very persuasive. And I don't really want to advertise things unless I have a sort of fanatical belief in them, which I acquire quite easily. And I really believe in all the products, almost all the things I've ever advertised.
Would you be willing... I'm sorry.
Some more than others.
Would you be willing to tell us some of the campaigns that you turned down?
No, I turned down a lot of accounts because I didn't like the people. There was a man called Rosenstiel who ran a company called Schenley, and he wanted us to work with him. I wouldn't work for him. And then there was a horrible man called Charles Revlon who owned a company called Charles Revson of Revlon. I was asked to go over there and work for them. I didn't want to work for him either. They were personal. There are lots of advertising agencies and lots of clients, and the thing is to make congenial marriages. They're the only ones that fructify, and not get into business with people you detest.
Another one of your ads that is still running, based on the campaign you created, is the Pepperidge Farm one, where an old baker with white hair and I believe a white beard is riding down the road in a white Pepperidge Farm buggy drawn by horses. How did you come up with that?
Well, that was I had to get an idea for Pepperidge Farm. They just started advertising their bread, and I couldn't get an idea. And one night I woke up, I had a dream about these two horses pulling this baker's delivery wagon down the road, country lane, which was an echo of the fact that I'd lived in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, for many years among the Amish. I'd been surrounded by horses and wagons. And I was lucky. I woke up and remembered the dream and wrote a note of it on a pad beside my bed. And I went back to sleep. In the morning, I got up and went into the office and made the commercial of it. And that wagon is still driving along that lane, delivering Pepperidge Farm bread. It's a sort of symbol of Pepperidge Farm's quality, you know. Pepperidge Farm remembers, you know, that thing they say all the time. I love that campaign. If you can't get an idea when you're awake, go to sleep. You may get one then. All good ideas, you see, come from the unconscious. The unconscious works better when you're asleep than when you're awake, apparently.
That campaign emphasized the old-world quality of and the old-fashioned quality of home-baked goods. And now there's a really strong emphasis on natural foods that's very modern, that doesn't necessarily have the attachment of being old-fashioned or old-world. What do you think the campaign continues to work?
I think people still respect old-fashioned quality. Of course, some old-fashioned quality was lousy, but the idea is it was all very good. And that's what people think. And I don't know, but Pepperidge Farm bread is very good bread. And the reason it sold so well, it's quite a romantic story, is that the bread had become so commercial, so white and so spongy and so tasteless and not worth eating. And here at last was a loaf of bread worth eating. And like bread had been in Grandma's day, really. And that's what, before those wretched commercial bakers got in and mucked it all up.
Do you think ads like that work equally well in the city? Do you think ads like the Pepperidge Farm work equally well in cities in the Northeast, for instance, where that kind of more rural image doesn't relate to day-to-day life?
Apparently it does, yes, just as well. It seems to work everywhere.
My guest is David Ogilvy, who's one of the world's leading advertisers, and he's a partner of Ogilvy & Mather, which is one of the four largest advertising companies in the world. He's written a new book called Ogilvy on Advertising that's just been published by Crown. Most of your ads, or many of your ads, have several columns of print beneath the photograph. I had always thought that in the advertising world you were discouraged by having too much copy in an ad, thinking that people were too busy and too harassed to actually read it, and you wanted something eye-catching that could be digested in as short a time as possible.
Different products, different solutions. I wouldn't use a lot of copy to sell bubble gum, but for many products, particularly expensive things like motor cars, you've got to give the consumer a lot of information, and that takes words. And, you know, there are some people who know exactly what every ad does. The people who sell out of the ad with a coupon at the bottom, they know exactly what happens when they run an ad. And they never use short copy. They always use long copy. It's not a theory. They just found that short copy doesn't sell and long copy does. The more you tell, the more you sell. But you know one of the reasons why a lot of people in advertising business don't write long copy? To write long copy, you've got to know a lot about the product. Know a lot about the product, you've got to do your homework, and it's very boring for most writers. And I've always done a lot of homework on products and found out a lot about them. The more you know about a product, the more likely you are to be able to sell it. Anyway, so I think. But I haven't always used long copy. Somebody once said to me, is your agency paid by the word?
You've done several
I did an ad recently for the World Wildlife Fund, which was 3,200 words long. It took a double spread in the newspapers in the New York Times. And that was a marvelous ad, all about the endangered species that the World Wildlife Fund had saved from becoming extinct. The headline, I remember, was Back from the Dead.
You've done campaigns for several countries. You did a tourism campaign for America, England, Puerto Rico.
And France.
Let's look at the Puerto Rico one. What was the problem that you had to solve, and how did you go about solving it?
Well, our clients there were that great man, Governor Luis Muñoz Marin of Puerto Rico, and the economic head of his government, Teodoro Moscoso. And their problem, there were several. The main problem was that more than 40% of the people in Puerto Rico were unemployed, and that island had been living on the edge of starvation for 400 years. And they had to get industry. They had to get people to go and start manufacturing there and bring jobs. And the chief obstacle I found was the terrible image of Puerto Rico. I had some research done, trust me. And the image was awful. It was a dreadful report to have to deliver to the government of Puerto Rico. People thought it was a dreadful place. And so I did this campaign to reveal what the truth was, what a lovely place Puerto Rico was, and how, contrary to belief, popular belief at the time, how wonderful the inhabitants were, how hard-working and decent people they were, which indeed they are. And that worked, and I can drive through the mountains of Puerto Rico today and come to community after community where those poor people who'd had such a terrible time, and they're now working, and there's a new school, and there's a new hospital, and the children have all got shoes. And I know that in many cases it was because I stayed home for a week and wrote the first ad, which was a very long copy, and that produced several hundred new factories. I'm awfully proud of that. St. Peter ever asks me, if you've done anything in your life you're proud of, I'll say, yes, one thing, Puerto Rico. And then we got fired. It's the change of government. And I didn't realize we were in patronage. And the wretched Republican government came in, fired everybody in sight, and put in their own gang. Damn their eyes.
What did you do for research for that? Did you go down on vacation? Did you go down on vacation in Puerto Rico before coming up with your campaign?
I didn't go on vacation. I went there and had a look and a talk and soaked myself in it. Last time I went to Puerto Rico, I had dinner with Muñoz, who was a very great man. We drank champagne. They got the Casals Festival, which was partly my doing, going there. And old Casals used to stay up all night in the governor's palace in San Juan with Muñoz, drinking champagne and playing Bach.
When you did your campaign for America to get tourists to come here, what did you emphasize about the United States?
Well, I did some research, and I found out what people in other countries most wanted to see here, and that's what I featured. It was Grand Canyon, San Francisco, Manhattan, Niagara Falls. And then one day, the client, the head of the United States Travel Service, said to me, I want you to do an ad now on South Dakota. I said, well, why in God's name South Dakota? He said, you innocent booby. The chairman of the committee which gives us, votes us our budget, is a congressman from South Dakota. So we duly did an ad for South Dakota. Wasn't it awful?
What did you find to promote?
Oh, well, Mount Rushmore. There's nothing else.
Do people really want to see the classic sites when they come to America?
Yes, they all want to see San Francisco. That's the biggest drawing card. Grand Canyon is a big drawing card. Manhattan is. It's a fairly limited thing. And the same thing with all countries. France, the only thing that most Americans want to see in France is Paris and the Côte d'Azur, which is a pity. I live in France, but it's a bigger subject than there. Clients are awful clients. Countries that make terrible clients, except for Puerto Rico. Awful. The French government still owes me money.
How much advertising do you see now? Do you watch television a lot? Read magazine ads when you're reading?
You know, for the last few years, I've been spending more than half the year in France. So the only advertising I see most is French advertising. I do see the stuff that my offices do is all sent to me, and I comment on it. But I'm not very up to date on what's going on TV in the United States. Entirely too much, of course.
You were the first person, I understand, to use a woman in an alcohol advertisement. It was for
rum,
and not use her as a sexual attraction, but to use her as someone who'd be as a consumer. Why did you decide to do that, and what effect did it have?
I guess I was rather naughty. I just wanted to do it. I didn't see why advertising should pretend that the only people who drank alcohol were men. So why not have women in natural settings? So I did it. There was no law against it. It was a convention in the liquor trade that you'd never have women in. Just it had been a convention years before that you should never have women in a cigarette ad. So I put women in the rum ads, and I thought the earth would open and swallow me up, but there was nobody noticed. It was a non-event. Now they're in it all the time.
Do you think advertising has gotten any more or less sexist since you started in the industry?
It depends where you're living. There's an awful lot of sexy advertising in Europe. Not much in the United States. The idea of draping blondes over the fronts of automobiles seems to be largely extinct now. I don't think there's much.
I don't know if you've...
It's not one of the major crimes of advertising today.
Have you seen enough American ads recently to see the new trend of males modeling underwear and males being very coyly posed to sell products now, something that was usually reserved for women?
Yes, I don't much like it.
Why not?
I don't know. I'm a prude. It embarrasses me, I suppose. But I suppose if you're selling men's drawers, you must advertise men's drawers, and they wear them on their bottoms, so you must photograph their bottoms.
I think they used to just be photographed sitting on a chair or something. You know, just like the underwear without anybody in it, or on a model, too. I think I remember a lot of those.
Sometimes the avoidance of impropriety is more improper than the impropriety itself would be. It's more prurient. It's more self-conscious.
You recommend to all advertisers that they do their homework and their research before coming up with a campaign. And you've developed several guidelines based on your research about what works and what doesn't. You say that although there's a lot of celebrity testimonials for products, that it's really not that ineffective. Why don't you think it works?
Well, so if you have movie stars, for example, in your advertising, first of all, it costs like hell. Some movie stars are getting $2 million a year to sponsor products. And that's very expensive. It's a lot of money. Secondly, the consumer is not a moron. She's your wife, and she knows perfectly well that the movie star's been bought, so she doesn't believe her. Those are the main reasons I don't do it. And my research has shown that what happens is that people remember the star, that they remember the celebrity, and forget the product. I only found that out a few years ago. I put it in my book. I put all my secrets in my book. It's the most self-destructive act.
Before you realized that celebrities don't work as well as people think they do, did you do a lot of celebrity ads?
I did some. I remember one thing I did. I got Mrs. Roosevelt to advertise margarine, the widow of the president, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And she was a wonderful woman. She did an awfully good job in the commercials. But people remembered Mrs. Roosevelt, but they forgot the margarine. I'm rather ashamed of that for all kinds of reasons. My Republican friend said, how could you use that woman? And my Democratic friend said, how could you drag Mrs. Roosevelt through the gutter of Madison Avenue? I lost on all counts, not my proudest moment.
Have there been celebrities who you asked to do testimonials who turned you down?
Well, I can think of two. The first was the great Julia Child, and I once talked to her on the telephone, I think. Never met her, and asked her if she would do some advertising for one of my clients, and offered an enormous sum of money. I can't remember if it was $60,000 or $100,000. And she absolutely refused point blank. She thought that her credibility would be threatened if she did that. I admired her for that. And the other person that everybody wants to do advertising is Walter Cronkite, who I think is the most admired, credible, believed person in the United States today. And I've offered him a fortune, absolutely almost unlimited, to represent a big corporation. So have many, many other people, and he won't go near it. God bless him.
You respect people for that?
Yes, I used to live next door to him. I'm devoted to him. He's a simply terrific man.
It's funny that you'd respect somebody for turning you down.
Oh, indeed, yes. Sometimes respect a woman if she refuses your hand in marriage, don't you? She knows enough.
David Ogilvy is my guest if you're just joining us, and we're discussing the subject of his new book, Ogilvy on Advertising. It's just been published by Crown. And we're going to just take a short break from this conversation to get the latest news on the traffic conditions. And Pat Ford, WHYY reporter from 91 Report, is with me with the latest traffic update.
Thank you, Terry. The Schuylkill Expressway remains closed in both directions between University and Spring Garden, and it is expected to stay that way for several hours at least. Police are urging motorists to take an alternate route. Broad Street, the River Drives, Ridge Avenue, Chestnut Street, and Walnut Street, or I-95 are suggested, but they warn you should expect delays on those roads, too, because of the extra volume of traffic. Public transit is probably your best bet. No delays reported so far on the commuter trains or the Market Frankfort L. Five bus routes, however, that take the expressway have been rerouted, so there are some delays on those. Troway and Greyhound report delays of about a half hour on buses in and out of the city. The start time of the Phillies game has been delayed a half hour, so you still have a few minutes to get there. The problem was caused by a four-vehicle accident this afternoon. A tanker truck flipped over and burst into flames. Fire officials say the truck was carrying a flammable liquid, probably gasoline, which leaked into the sewer and drainage system, and fire officials are still on being wary of an possible underground explosion. PennDOT fears that there may have been some structural damage to the expressway as a result of the accident. However, their engineers have been unable to investigate because of that danger of a possible explosion. So once again, you're advised to avoid the Schuylkill Expressway if you have to go through the city.
Okay, thanks for that report, Pat. And Pat Ford will continue to provide us shadow traffic updates throughout the afternoon. We'll have another report in about a half hour, and then another again at 4:30 and at 5 o'clock before joining National Public Radio on All Things Considered. Right now, the time is 3:29, and this is Fresh Air on 91 FM. And I'm speaking with David Ogilvie, who is the founder of one of the four largest advertising agencies in the world with 140 offices in 40 countries. And he's written a new book. We're discussing the subject of it. It's called Ogilvie on Advertising, and it's just been published by Crown. And the book title, again, is called Ogilvie on Advertising. You say that direct sales has a lot of lessons in it to be learned by people who aren't marketing that way. Mm. Maybe you should explain for our audience what direct sales are or
well,
is.
Well, I put a commercial on the air. And at the end of the commercial, I don't say go to your supermarket, you'll find it there. I say go to your telephone, call up such and such a number and order it over the phone or write in and we'll send it to you. That's what I call direct. And so they know exactly what the result is. Most of us don't know at all. And they find a lot of things that are very interesting. They find they can't sell anything under 2 minutes. Most commercials are 30 seconds, and I think it's reasonable to assume that most 30-second commercials don't sell much. 2 minutes would be better. Would be more cost-effective. They also find that commercials late at night sell much more than commercials in prime time, which is very strange. Nobody knows that. You pay a huge premium to get on premium at prime time. It's a waste of money. Better go on late at night. Isn't that fascinating? And a lot of other things. For example, in print, they use long copy, very long. It's all factual. And they give you every imaginable reason for buying the product and tell you everything it will do for you. And they never play the fool. They don't entertain in their commercials. That's the bane of advertising today. So many people do it. They're not salesmen at all. They're trying to entertain the public. And I don't know why manufacturers should pay good money to entertain. Leave that to the stations, the networks. It's their job. And the manufacturer's money, his stockholder's money, should be spent on selling his product, nothing else. You see, I don't regard advertising as an art form.
How have you applied the lessons of direct sales to your own work?
Well, certainly long copy. I'm always trying to get our people to write long commercials, but they're so damned expensive to produce and to buy the time for. I'm not having much luck with that. I think gradually there's more advertising late at night than there was, and early in the morning they pull very well too. I've always been interested in direct response. The first thing I ever did was in direct response. When I was knee-high to a grasshopper, a man had bought a country house in England, was turning it into a hotel, and opening day was a few weeks off, and he hadn't got any reservations. Why should he? Nobody had ever heard of him. And he'd got $500 to spend on advertising. It wasn't very much. And I took it, and I bought penny postcards and mailed them out with a lot of copy on. And the hotel opened. Full. I tasted blood. And from then on, nobody could stop me. It was direct response. I've always been rather a voice crying in the wilderness over direct response. Most advertising agents don't take much interest in it, or didn't, but now it's growing. And direct mail, too. Direct mail's very big. It's growing more and more. Computers have brought about a sort of explosion in direct mail. And Everybody who works in advertising should start off in direct mail. Put his feet on the ground.
The funny thing about those ads is that they're usually the laughing stock of viewers. They're the first ads to be parodied on shows like Saturday Night Live. Everybody has at least one friend who does an It Dices and Slices parody. So it's amazing that they work so well. They're so effective in getting some people to call, and on the other hand, people think that they're the silliest and most amateurish-looking commercials on the air.
I'm not talking so much about commercials on the air. I'm talking about print ads and some of the commercials. Well, if you do a direct response ad on TV and it's done well, there'll be nothing to laugh at in it. It's all a demonstration of what the product does. It's not nonsense.
Do you think that humor sells?
I didn't used to think so, and I don't believe it did. I used to believe that people didn't buy from clowns. But the last research I've got in shows that humor can sell. It's above average in selling. It's got to be handled right, and which is a great relief to me because I don't want to bore people into buying product. I love being able to do funny commercials. I can't do them myself because I have no sense of humor, but I love it when my colleagues do funny ones.
What are some of your favorite ad campaigns that you've seen done over the years?
Oh, I suppose the two best campaigns I've ever seen, the first was for Avis, you know, We Try Harder. That was a marvelous campaign and worked too. And the other was for Marlboro Cigarettes and still is. My friend Leo Burnett started advertising Marlboro Cigarettes 25 years ago with a cowboy. And that campaign is still running. When it started, Marlboro was an unheard-of brand of cigarette, and it's now the biggest-selling cigarette in the world, and that cowboy campaign for Marlboro has worked all over the world, not just in the United States.
Why do you think that's worked? It's certainly different than what you do. It's not about the quality of the cigarette. It's selling a macho image to its consumers.
Yes, it is, and I couldn't do that, could I? Maybe the Hathaway and the Schweppes things weren't too far off that, but no copy. Somebody else's style. I do admire other people's style sometimes. I admired Bill Birnbach's style, and I admired Leo Burnett's style, which was highly posterized.
Are there ad campaigns that you really liked a lot, but they didn't work?
Some of my own I liked a lot, and they didn't work. I used to think those commercials for Alka-Seltzer are the funny ones. I rather like them, but I don't think they worked very well. That was a mistake. There's a difference between my liking something. I may like a thing personally as an individual human being, but say to myself, while I like that, I don't believe it's going to sell that product. For example, I don't think you should make jokes about headaches or indigestion. I don't think that sells. I've reason to believe it doesn't sell. You've got to be serious. Some subjects lend themselves to humour in advertising, and some don't. I wouldn't run funny advertising about an automobile.
You don't usually use jingles in your broadcast commercials. What do you think of jingles?
I excoriate jingles. There have been a few jingles which have probably been successful, but most jingles are useless and a waste of money because people can't hear the words. You can't decipher the words. And I always say, if you have nothing to say, sing it. But if you've got something to say about your product, don't sing it, say it. But almost all the advertising I hear on the radio has got jingles, inane jingles. Some clients think that you're not giving them their money's worth unless you give them a jingle. You know, if you went into Sears Roebuck and went to a salesman and said, I'd like to look at a frying pan or hammer or something, he started singing at you, you'd think you'd got a lunatic by the hand. It's the people who do jingles, they're not salesmen, they're entertainers. The direct response people would never dream of using a jingle.
Will you take
I want to be intelligible. I've got something to say about a product, and I don't want any monkey coming along and singing while I'm saying it.
The soda wars, like between all the colas and the other carbonated beverages, seldom really talk about their ingredients, except if it's got no sugar and no caffeine. And the advertising is usually based on image, you know, like Pepsi Generation,
yeah,
or feeling free and how great you're going to feel and you'll have a terrific time at the beach. It seems like it must be very successful for them. They've certainly kept it up for a long time.
Yes, maybe it's been successful. I don't know to what extent Coca-Cola owes its success to its advertising, or Pepsi. Of course, Pepsi have done some pretty hard-boiled advertising, blind taste tests of Pepsi against Coca-Cola, but they never mention their ingredients. How could they? And it is, as you say, mostly image. That's probably the best way to advertise soft drinks.
Well, there's
it's essentially the way I advertise Schweppes, which is a sort of soft drink.
Mm-hmm. From the image. There's an emphasis now on corporate image advertising, whereas you used to see Texaco people singing and pumping gas. You're now more apt to see ads for, like, the Mobil Corporation or Exxon as being supporters of ecology and the American way and the future of energy resources. It's all promoting their image as opposed to sales at the gas pump. What do you think caused that turnaround?
Well, the oil companies have had a lot of problems in recent years, and when there were gas lines, people waiting for an hour to get some gas put in their tanks, they began to get mad at the oil companies. They had some other problems too, and their profits went up. And they got very unpopular. I think big oil companies have always been unpopular. I know they have. And I've never understood why, but they have been unpopular. And it's very difficult for a company if it's unpopular with the public at large, especially the voters. And it's unpleasant for their employees if their companies are detested by the public. So for one reason or another, the oil companies have been trying to make themselves more popular and more credible, and I think some of them are doing a rather good job at it. I think Shell is, which is the one we happen to do.
Yeah, there's a Shell ad in your book that was done for British Shell, and there's a picture of a very green, lush piece of land with a little island in it on a lake, and the headline is, oh, and a beautiful sunset. And the headline is, wouldn't you protest if Shell ran a pipeline through this beautiful countryside? Then beneath it, it says they already have! Exclamation point. And then the ad goes on to discuss that Shell is really careful when they run pipeline through the country, and in spite of the controversy, they keep the land beautiful, and you couldn't tell the difference after the pipeline was laid. Was that a successful ad?
Yeah, insofar as it's been measured. I'll tell you the locus classicus, how this corporate advertising started for an oil company. It was about 1941 or 42, when Texaco were caught trading with the Nazis, and they got a terrible press over it, and they fired their wonderful head man. And so what did they do? They'd got an image problem. They were really suffering, awful public relations problem. So they sponsored the Metropolitan Opera every Saturday afternoon on the radio. And as far as I know, they're still doing it. How many years later? 40 years later. So it's an ill wind which blows nobody any good. And that was the first case I know of an oil company. But no, there was one, but soon after that, there was a head of an oil company who went into Cartier and he picked out a beautiful bracelet of diamonds and sapphires and frightfully expensive. And he told the salesman to charge it to his address and he gave the name of his address, the chairman of this vast oil company. And Cartier had never heard of the oil company. And this was too much for the man. He couldn't bear the idea. Nobody had heard of his huge corporation. So the next morning, he went into his office and he ordered up a corporate campaign. Corporate advertising, most of it, is rather pompous. And it's all about how great the company is. And corporate advertising only works if they have something to say which is of interest to the reader and puts it in terms of what's in it for the reader. But these breast-beating, self-adulatory advertising things that corporations run about, how great we, the corporation, are. We're the biggest, we're the best, we do all that. That's not worth spending any money on at all. I read a lot of corporate advertising. I'm rather interested in it, and not much of it's any good. Some of it is.
Is there any way of proving the success?
Oh, yes. You measure people's attitudes to the corporation on different criteria, and you do that every 6 months or so, and If they're getting a better report card from the public, you know the advertising is working. And if they're getting a worse report card, you know the advertising isn't working.
Do you think that there's any ethical questions that face an advertiser who's changing the public image of a company that really is working on the effect of ecology and natural resources, and they're changing the public's effect not necessarily with the facts and the full presentation, but rather with image and slogans?
You have a hard job being dishonest in advertising today because The lawyers are looking over your shoulders all the time. And in the New York office where I've been made, there are 3 full-time lawyers, and everything is written has to go before them. And if they okay it, which is unlikely, but if they finally okay it, then it has to go to the networks, and they turn down half the commercials which are submitted to them because they think they're dishonest. And if you get over that hurdle, finally, you've got Uncle Sam waiting for you in the Federal Trade Commission, and if he finds that your advertising is dishonest, he issues a cease and desist order, and you can't go on doing it. You may be debarred forever from doing anything like that. So the consumer is very well protected, much better than she realizes.
You keep calling the consumer she. Do you think of most consumers as women?
I always think of consumers as women because most of the things which are advertised, you know, are bought by women and used by women. And the funny thing is that so much of the advertising should be produced by men. No man is ever going to use that, buy that product.
Do you think
so
that's
I always
changed?
Think of the consumer as a woman. It isn't always true. Women don't smoke or don't consume many cigars. And I think most motor cars, most automobiles are chosen by the man and the family. But most advertising is a thing for women. And thank goodness, women are being employed more in advertising today.
David Ogilvy is my guest. He's written a new book called Ogilvy on Advertising. You live in France half the year and see a lot of European advertising, and your company, Ogilvy & Mather, has outlets in 40 different countries. So I know you're very aware of advertising in different countries. Let's look at some of the advertising in communist countries, because it's a kind of advertising that very few Americans are exposed to. Do the ad campaigns differ much?
Yes, a lot of people are surprised to learn that there is such a thing as advertising, that capitalist tool in the communist countries, but there is. There's very little in Russia, but there's quite a lot in Eastern Europe, in Hungary and Romania, little in Poland, Bulgaria, and now with some advertising in China and a little in Russia, but not much. It's prehistoric. It's incredibly amateurish and bad. I always wonder if they asked me to go and teach them how to advertise where I'd go. I hope I wouldn't. But that is in Hungary, there's a whole magazine devoted to the subject of advertising. They're the best of the communist countries. Now, in the rest of the world, the best advertising in the world probably could be said to be coming out of England today. Of course, when I was first in advertising, American advertising was 30 years ahead of the rest of the world. But that's no longer true. The turtle has caught up with the hare, and the advertising in England is widely admired by ad people in the United States, and quite rightly so. There's some lovely stuff coming out of England. The French advertising that I see, a lot of it is very witty and charming, and I love it, but I often wonder if my cook can understand those French commercials. German advertising isn't bad. It's mostly rather ugly, graphically, visually. Some countries, in Southeast Asia, they are really going like gangbusters. I've been out there, and the advertising coming out of my office in Bangkok, in Thailand, is as good as any coming out of big offices in places like New York or Chicago or London or Paris. The Thais are doing wonderful advertising. Singapore, Malaysia. India's not quite so good. A rather bolshy girl in India, the daughter of the manager of our company there, said to me the other day, she's 19, college student, said, "Mr. Ogilvy, do you know what advertising is?" I said, "No, what is advertising?" She said, "Advertising is organized graffiti." I thought she needed a bottom smack, but it's a pretty witty thing to say, isn't it?
There's a lot more nude advertising in European countries where it's not an extraordinary thing to see women with bare breasts advertising a product. What accounts for the difference in standards between European and countries in America?
Well, advertising doesn't lead the mores of countries. It follows it. And I suppose that the Europeans are much more permissive. In London the other day, I was staying in a hotel there, and I had the TV turned on for a drama, and at 10:15, the woman who was just going to bed with a man undressed on camera, totally bare naked, and stood there facing the camera. I couldn't believe my eyes. And so that it's not surprising occasionally to see nude. I saw them in a German ad the other day. I saw the most famous of all 4-letter obscenities in the headline of an ad in English.
Really?
I've yet to see, which is a commonplace in novels, you know, in literature in the United States. But I've yet to see it in ad. We ad men, generally speaking, are rather conservative in the things we show and say. Lucky, isn't it?
Do you expect at some point that four-letter words will enter American advertising?
I don't know. I'm getting so old, I don't care what happens after I'm gone. I don't think I'll live to see it.
Do you think that, your company has branches in 40 different countries. Are they usually called on to run campaigns for American products and give that product an American image and sell that American image to whichever country they're based in?
No, a lot of the campaigns we do all over the world, in the United States, in Europe, and Southeast Asia. We're never called upon to project an American image. These international agencies, which are almost entirely American agencies, are often charged with sort of spreading an unpleasant American culture. It's not true. Insofar as that charge can be sustained, it doesn't come from the advertising on television in those countries. It comes from the American programs. For example, in Europe today, what is the most popular of all TV programs? It's Dallas. Don't ask me why, but it is. I wish it was, but it is. And that is certainly having an influence, and a baleful one too, for my money. But advertising, I don't think, does. And how would a Thai or a Chinese advertising person know how to project an American culture? Of course, everything I'm saying is an oversimplification of a complicated subject. The Marlboro cigarette advertising all over the world is essentially projecting an American image, the cowboy thing. But I don't think it's never thought of in nationalistic terms. Nobody's, at least seldom. Some people do, some consumers, particularly kids in a lot of these countries, do want to come off, look very American. Jeans and all that stuff.
I understand that in some European countries, I think in Italy this happens, there's no commercials that interrupt television programs, but rather at the end of the day and at pre-assigned hours, there's a half hour or an hour of commercials, and it's almost like catalog sales. It's almost like thumbing through a catalog where you find out what fashions are being shown and what sales are happening at different stores.
Well, no country in the world is being drowned in advertising as much as the United States is, where the bombardment is unrelenting and repulsive. In all the rest of the world, it is rationed. It's limited to some extent. In France, we have commercials between the programs, not during them. You don't see some superb drama interrupted with commercials. It's under control there. And sooner or later, of course, it's got to be controlled in this country. Why it hasn't been already, God alone knows.
Do you think that saturation of advertising decreases the potency of the message since you're so swamped?
It does in print. I know that in magazines. Advertisements in thin issues of magazines sell more than advertisements in short issues. I've never seen any figures. An interesting question you raise. I've never seen any figures to establish whether clutter, as we call it on television, whether your commercial sells more. Oh, yes, I have. Direct response. Here we go again. Those two-minute commercials late at night are generally by themselves, and they sell more. Whereas if you have a 10-second or 30-second commercial on a network, it's apt to be jammed in among six or seven others. So it's like having six or seven salesmen call on your house, knock the door in rapid succession. So when you buy those long commercials, you can get a sort of island, isolated position. They do sell more. But I'm pleading for fewer commercials, less clutter, and not in the commercial interest, but just as somebody like you who has to watch and listen. Do you know that some of the radio stations in this country, 40 minutes in every hour devoted to commercials?
Did you ever wish that you could sign your name at the bottom of a magazine ad so everybody knew that you did it?
Yes, I've done it. The Reader's Digest once asked me to do an ad for them. They weren't clients of mine, and I did it. I said I'd do it for money. They had to give some money to my old school, which is running a capital fund drive. They gave a very large sum of money, and I wrote an ad. It had to appear over my signature. My name, by David Over, right at the top. I've never worked so hard on an ad in my whole life. Everyone was going to know who'd written it, and they got a good ad out of me, the Reader's Digest. They ran it again about 5 years later. And in France, all the ads are signed by the agencies, and I got the Germans to do it now. All the ads in Germany are being signed. And I hope that one day the agencies will sign all their advertising, both in radio, both in TV and print, in the United States. Then the advertisers will get better advertising out of their agencies. Advertising is almost the only form of writing today which isn't signed. Newspaper articles all signed, magazine articles own. Why should the ad men be the only anonymous writers left.
Well,
when you're going to sign a thing, you accept responsibility for it, and that's good.
We're about out of time, but I wonder if you have any closing comments you'd like to make on the advertising industry and the direction you see it headed in.
Well, I hope that the advertising is going to become more factual and more informative. I hope that politicians are going to clean up their commercials so they won't be so flagrantly dishonest. I hope that billboards will be abolished, posters, because they're a form of environmental pollution, and they make the roads where there are billboards have a higher incidence of accidents than the roads without billboards. So I hope that will be seen too. What else do I hope? These really aren't predictions. They're hopes. And I hope this clutter, this awful barrage, will be reduced to make life worth living for these people who lead vicarious lives 6.5 hours a day with the TV turned on.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. It's been very interesting. David Ogilvie has been my guest. And he's a co-founder of Ogilvie & Mather, which is now one of the four largest advertising companies in the world. They have 140 different branches in 40 different countries. David Ogilvie has just written a new book. It's called Ogilvie on Advertising, and it's just been published by Crown. It's 5 minutes to 4 o'clock, and this is Fresh Air on WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. David Ogilvie's book, once again, is called Ogilvie on Advertising. Coming up this afternoon at approximately 4:30, we'll be hearing from television personality and chef Julia Child, who has a new series that's scheduled for public television that will begin here in the Delaware Valley on Channel 12 Monday evening at 8 o'clock. It's called Dinner at Julia's. And in just a couple of minutes on Fresh Air, I'll be joined by Scott B., who along with Beth B. have done a new independent new wave film called Vortex, which opens today at the TLA on South Street. Before we meet him and before we hear excerpts of the soundtrack of that movie, let's check in with Shadow Traffic.
A tanker truck carrying a flammable liquid, probably gasoline, failed to negotiate a curve near 30th Street and flipped over, crashing into two cars and a small truck and touching off a series of explosions and fires. Two people are confirmed dead. Fire officials are still on the scene trying to contain leakage from the truck, and PennDOT officials are inspecting the road for possible structural damage. The expressway is closed in both directions, and of course that's causing travel problems. We get details from John Brown at Shadow Traffic.
Good afternoon, everyone. Traffic's still a problem on the Schuylkill Expressway, as it is still closed at 30th. Eastbound closed at Girard, westbound closed at South Street, all due to that accident involving the overturned tanker tractor trailer, which did explode, causing structural damage to the Schuylkill Expressway. The Schuylkill Expressway westbound's cleared out nicely. Eastbound is still slow from Montgomery through the closure at Girard. Your heaviest volume right now on the detours, Girard Avenue, the drives. Southbound Broad is very heavy from Temple University through City Hall and again from Washington through Passyunk as you head into South Philadelphia. Schuylkill Expressway, do avoid. It's going to be closed for quite some time. And, of course, 95 is your best alternate out of town. Westbound Vine Street is now open to westbound Schuylkill Expressway. The ramp from westbound Vine to eastbound is still closed. That's Shadow Traffic for WHYY 91 FM. This is John Brown.
We'll continue with special shadow traffic reports throughout the afternoon. We'll have another one coming up at approximately 4:30, and we'll check in again before 5 o'clock when we join National Public Radio for All Things Considered. 3 minutes to 4 is the time now. This is WHYY FM in Philadelphia. Coming up in a couple of minutes, we'll be joined by Scott B., who, along with Beth B., has done a new wave film that's called Vortex. It opens today at the TLA Cinema on South Street and continues there through tomorrow. Vortex is a new wave interpretation of the detective genre. And before we meet Scott B., let's listen to a selection from the Vortex soundtrack.